Hello and welcome to this podcast from Don't Forget the Bubbles. If you enjoy our podcasts, please tell your colleagues and subscribe on iTunes and Spotify. Enjoy!
Welcome to Fontanelle, the podcast with a soft spot for paediatrics. I'm Caroline Story, a paediatric trainee in Wessex, and I'm in the Dorset County Hospital Children's Centre with Dr. Claire Hollingsworth, a consultant general paediatrician, and we're talking today about bronchiolitis.
So I think the first thing to say is bronchiolitis is really common. Bronchiolitis is caused by a viral infection. Mm-hmm. There are lots of viruses that can cause bronchiolitis, and the most common one that we see in our little children is respiratory syncytial virus, RSV, but there are other types of virus that can cause the same symptom pattern, and they're managed in essentially the same way. Typically, adenovirus would be a cohort of children that may have more severe symptoms and maybe the ones that are more likely to go on to develop further complications like bronchiolitis obliterans, or they're more likely to be needing to be intubated. Mm. But certainly we have the biggest number of cases of bronchiolitis is down to RSV over the winter period.
And RSV is just something that is about, isn't it? Causes the common cold in the ORI.
So we would get a nasty, snotty, coldy disease. But when infants, so in the UK we describe this group of kids who get bronchiolitis, they're under a year of age, and when they get RSV, they start with exactly the same symptoms really as an adult. They're snotty, runny nose, they cough, they may sneeze as well. And then in smaller children in that infant group, they develop respiratory symptoms on top of that. So they will have an increased work of breathing. Whereas as adults, our virus is sort of maintained in the upper airway. Mm-hmm. Children will have infants will have lower airway involvement, including more secretions, so lots of mucus production.
Yeah.
They'll have bronchoconstriction, and so they will then develop this very classical pattern that we see, where for the first few days of their illness they'll be snotty and maybe sneezing and coughing, and then perhaps day three to four of the illness they'll develop increased work of breathing. And with that we see all different types of signs in children. In tiny babies, they may head bob. We may see indrawing, so subcostal recession and intercostal recession. And again, in the older infants, we'll see those similar signs. In children where their neck isn't so fat that it's covering up their sternal notch, you'll see tracheal tug.
Mm-hmm.
And with that, there are implications on babies feeding, because little babies obviously feed on milk. And they are also what we call obligate nasal breathers. So they want to breathe through their nose. And when their nose is full of snot, they can't. So that means that when you put a bottle or a boob in their mouth, they spit it out because they want to breathe over feed, which is a good survival
that makes
mechanism.
Sense.
But it means that children with bronchiolitis who are really struggling cannot feed enough, and they can become dehydrated. So that's another problem that we see alongside the respiratory symptoms.
So they're the two main sort of branches of what we worry about.
Yeah.
The breathing and the feeding.
Absolutely. And when I'm assessing, I think when GPs and junior doctors are assessing children with bronchiolitis, it's a good framework just to think about the respiratory side of things and then the feeding side of things.
Perfect.
Because in terms of admission criteria and when we would start to worry more and want to bring these children into hospital, I would think about those in those two groups. So I would think about the respiratory reasons why a child might need to come to hospital, such as if their work of breathing is really significant, then they look like they're actually getting physically and physically tired.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing that we haven't talked about yet is the measurement of oxygen saturation. So mm-hmm. within our respiratory assessment, the efficacy of breathing can be measured by how well oxygen is being delivered to the tissues. And if children are struggling to deliver adequate oxygen to their tissues, then that's another reason, obviously, that they would need to come to hospital for additional oxygen therapy and supplementation.
Yeah. So if
So if there are low saturations or there's significant work of breathing, that would be a criteria for admission?
Yes, certainly. One. So if you look at the Wessex Health Year Together bronchiolitis pathway, it's really nicely sectioned up into our green and our amber and our red high risk in terms of severity of illness, and that would have implications then about admission. So if your saturations are less than 92%, it puts you into the red high risk category box, and that would certainly need to be assessed in hospital. Respiratory rate above 70 breaths per minute in an infant again puts you into the red high risk group, and again would imply that you'd need further assessment in a secondary care setting.
Okay, so in that red high risk group, we've got that low SATs. It talks about cyanosis as well and unable to rouse. So obviously, they're really worrying features.
Yeah.
What about this amber intermediate risk group? What do we do with those? So that's ones who may have pallor. They've got increased work of breathing. They've got a respiratory rate over 60, but their SATs are over 92. They're between 92 and 94. And they're sort of taking over half their feeds.
Mm-hmm.
What would we
so they're a do? They're a tricky group, as you're implying, and I think particularly they're a tricky group in the primary care setting because often you don't actually have an accurate saturation monitoring. It's really important to try to. But if you've got children in this amber risk group, there are some important things you need to think about. The first thing is, have you got the diagnosis right? So it's always important to think about your differential diagnosis with these babies.
Mm-hmm.
And as I've explained, bronchiolitis is a very typical clinical picture where we see a few days of coryzal illness with ongoing and increasing work of breathing. And on the chest, when you listen, very classical early on crackles, so bilateral crackles. There's usually no focal signs. It's just a generally really noisy, wet-sounding chest. And then as you go further into that illness, you'll hear more in the way of wheeze and bronchospasm. So make sure you've got your diagnosis right. If you kind of tick all those boxes, the likelihood is this is bronchiolitis. But you need to think, if you've got really high fever, actually, is this sepsis? Is it pneumonia? You need to think about a baby's blood sugar and whether actually this could be a work of breathing because of a metabolic presentation. There are various other things that would need to be in your differential diagnosis.
Just to interrupt you there for a second, if you have got a fever, can you still have bronchiolitis? Because I know that that's confused people.
Absolutely. So children with bronchiolitis often do have a low-grade
fever. And that's okay.
It is okay. And I think we're very, obviously, the nice guidance for assessing fever, and specifically, particularly, in children under 3 months of age is very clear. It's clear about needing to go on and do a full septic screen, but what it does say is if you've got a really obvious reason for a fever, for instance, a child who's got an absolutely classical picture of bronchiolitis, you can accept that fever as part of that illness. Obviously, you'd have a very low threshold. And if that child was, you know, popping petechiae all over its body, or there were other things that were worrying you, you'd need to think about further investigations. So in terms of this amber group, we need to make sure we've got the diagnosis right, consider other differentials. We also then, once we've decided this is bronchiolitis, need to think about how far into the illness we are. So if you're seeing a baby who is on day one or two of this illness and is already in the amber group, then that would worry me more than if we were more like day five or six into the illness, because what tends to happen is you have a peak at around day four or five of how bad the baby's going to be. If you're before that peak, then the chances are the baby's going to get worse before it gets better. And so I always think about the course of the illness and where you are on that timeline.
So that's a really important part of the history, isn't it?
I think it's really vital. And sometimes it's missed. And also for GPs then phoning secondary care, it's a really nice, quick sort of summary. I've got a baby who is day two of illness and is already looking tachypneic and has increased work of breathing. I'm worried they're going to get worse. Therefore, I need some further assessment. So course of illness, make sure you've got the diagnosis right. Then another thing in this amber group to think about is whether there are any reasons why this baby might be more at risk than another baby. So we've got groups of babies that we see that are higher risk. So premature babies, so they may be have been born premature and now correct to term, but those babies are still more concerning to us because they are likely to have lower birth weight, they're likely to be potentially somewhat immunocompromised, and they also potentially are going to have chronic lung disease, or they may even have ongoing oxygen requirement at home, which would obviously put them into a higher risk group. Any small children, so babies at less than 6 weeks of age, even if they were born at term, fall into a higher risk. They're more vulnerable to the complications and the more serious bronchiolitic pattern or picture, I suppose. Mm-hmm. Any babies with underlying chronic disease, so congenital heart disease, neuromuscular disease, mm-hmm. so babies that maybe don't mount a respiratory response in the mm-hmm. same way as a normal baby. Other babies to worry about. So if this baby has come back to see you, so maybe it's been assessed already and actually then the parents have come back, so reattendance is a feature that you shouldn't ignore, because parents know their babies, don't they? Mm. They know their babies better than anybody, and actually if they're worried their baby's getting worse, or that they haven't had their kind of their worries assessed in the first place, then and they're back to see you, then I would take that seriously.
Just thinking about, so those high risk groups, the premature ones, they I think also they're quite concerning in a way, because they can present slightly differently, can't they?
Absolutely. So we haven't talked about apnea, but in the little babies, and particularly in the ex-prems and in that sort of early neonatal period, sometimes babies will present with apnea as a sign of bronchiolitis, underlying bronchiolitis. We're not really clear on the underlying mechanism for that, but certainly the little babies do tend to have apnea as a presenting feature.
So when that happens, does that tend to be the first sort of a clue to this illness, and then it progresses into more classical picture of bronchiolitis rather than them having respiratory distress and then just
it can apnea. Be absolutely. So you'd sometimes get the snot as well and then apnea later on, but yes, absolutely, it can be early, and then obviously your differential diagnosis needs to be wide. If you're seeing an infant or a small baby with apnea, there's a bigger differential diagnosis, and so sometimes, as you say, they actually undergo some investigations before they then, on day two or three, start to get the classical snot and secretions. And everyone says, oh, obviously the baby's got bronchiolitis.
So we've talked about tachypnea as being something concerning, and so for babies in this age group, we're thinking of over 60, really.
Yes, so up to a year of age, a respiratory rate up to 50 is deemed okay. And I think that's obviously in the bigger context as well, of including the assessment of the work of breathing. But if you've got babies with respiratory rates persistently above 60, then that is a concerning feature and needs to at least be explored and investigated.
Yeah. And would you expect these babies to be tachycardic as well?
They often are tachycardic. Mm.
Is that because they're a bit dry?
Yes, it's because they're a bit dry. It's sometimes because they're very cross. so these babies will not like being snotty. They're often hungry because they can't feed enough. Mm. And also they're tachycardic sometimes because they're a bit hot. So sometimes they have a low-grade fever, which makes them tachycardic. So a whole number of things feeding into that physiological finding.
So the heart rate that we'd... the normal range that we'd accept would be, so it says on the Wessex Healthier Together, 110 to 160 for this age group.
Yeah,
so.
And obviously that's quite a wide range. And I think one of the really useful things to do is, if you're on a paediatric assessment unit, just watch the direction of that tachycardia. So lots of babies will come in and their initial obs will show a heart rate of perhaps above 160 in the sort of 180s. And actually, if that's persistent or increasing, then we would be worrying more. If that's coming down as babies are settling, perhaps with some oxygen therapy, then that's a reassuring sign.
Great. Okay, so the baby's been referred in, been assessed in the paediatric assessment unit, and we've decided that the baby is working hard, it's only on day two of the illness, and perhaps needing help with feeds too. So we're going to admit the baby. What happens then?
So usually what happens is the parents cry, especially if it's the first baby. So I think that's a bit, me being a bit cheeky, but actually this is, although we see it loads, I think we forget what a significant thing this is for parents. So make sure that they're being, you know, well looked after. We can see, you know, 10 of these babies a day on our busy paediatric assessment units, probably more, I'm sure, in busy places in Wessex. But actually each of these babies needs to be kind of cared for in the context of their family. So I'll put that in there, because I'm a holistic touchy-feely paediatrician, but look after the parents, explain what's going to happen. And what is going to happen is we're going to play it by ear a little bit. So babies respond in different ways. They some respond very quickly, and actually just need some low flow oxygen to keep their sats within the normal range. And some will need an NG tube to help with feeding. So often we will kind of change the baby's feeding pattern a little bit, because when babies have got increased work of breathing, often they can't tolerate a really big feed. So breastfeeding mums often want to comfort their baby with a big breastfeed, and actually, although for perhaps a few seconds it does comfort them, it often causes problems afterwards, because their tiny little stomachs have been distended with a big milk feed, and that just it causes increased work of breathing. It makes it harder for the babies to fill those lungs. So we often will feed little and often, so we'll perhaps start at between 80 and 100 mils per kilo per day, and then give that in 2 hourly amounts. But that's, you know, that there's no rule about this. It's often something the nurses will help guide you with. Some babies will tolerate their feeds fine, even when they've got increased work of breathing, but I think you need to just think about the way that you're going to feed the baby and involve the parents with that plan.
And you're just constantly reviewing how much they are feeding and whether they
absolutely
need.
So really important to start a fluid in and out chart, you know, a good balance sheet with parents writing down what the babies are having, with nurses contributing to that as well, so that we can get an idea of fluid balance, because occasionally babies really can't tolerate feeding. It is causing them increased respiratory distress, and so we do sometimes need to give babies IV fluids. That's more rare, and we do that carefully, because they're also at risk of developing SIADH, and so we don't want to give them lots and lots of fluid. We need to be careful and restrict their fluid if we're doing that IV.
And it's important then to keep the NG tube in at that point, isn't it, so that we can aspirate any air that's
So depending on how you're delivering your oxygen, and whether babies are swallowing lots of air down, it is useful to get air out. As babies are improving, I quite like to get the NG tubes out quite early on, because I think if a baby's going to be able to feed orally, it's much easier to do that without an NG tube in than when it's there sort of irritating their gag reflex. But that is as they're improving. But yeah, in the acute setting, it's useful.
Great. Okay, so let's talk about the respiratory support that's on offer.
Okie coke. So we have got different methods of delivering oxygen to babies. In terms of our what we allow in terms of oxygen saturations, the Healthier Together advice suggests that SATs below 92% are not normal, and therefore you should need supplementary oxygen. I'll talk a bit later about as babies are improving and actually what we allow in terms of saturations. But if you need to deliver oxygen, the first line method is by delivering nasal oxygen. You could deliver face mask oxygen, but again, with babies they don't keep that on, so they'll just flick it off. Back in the day we used to use head boxes. And actually some places they still do use head box oxygen, and babies tolerate it much better. So if you haven't seen it, if you're really young, it's basically like a big Perspex box that goes over the baby's head, and oxygen is delivered via a pipe into it to kind of surround the baby in oxygen.
Don't they also have tents?
Yes, they have tents. Yeah, I mean, there's all sorts of methods. it is a bit old school, but it is a useful, if babies won't tolerate having the prongs up their nose, which sometimes, and also when there's lots of snot, sometimes it's quite tricky, and small noses when you're trying to get an NG tube up and a nasal prong can be quite tricky. More and more we're using high flow nasal cannula oxygen therapy. There's lots of different types of machine that will deliver that, but essentially what you're doing is humidifying oxygen and delivering it at a higher flow than you would do just with your standard nasal prong oxygen. It is useful for a number of reasons. If you look at the evidence for actually how much pressure support is being delivered by high flow, it's a bit unclear, but certainly there is an argument to say that you are basically giving the baby a little bit of peep. It's not like CPAP. There's no seal. Exactly. But in my view, and I think from the reading that I've done, I think to me in bronchiolitis, one of the main benefits of high flow is that it's humidified, and that helps with secretions. So you get lots of secretions in bronchiolitis, and actually loosening those secretions, and particularly in the babies that we then that deteriorate and need to be intubated, we know that getting rid of those secretions and physio in an intubated and ventilated baby is often the mainstay of therapy for bronchiolitis. Yeah. So actually any method of being able to just loosen those secretions so that they can be kind of swallowed or got rid of in one way or the other, suction if possible, is useful.
Yeah. So would that replace saline nebs, or do we still give those on top?
So NICE guidance for bronchiolitis looks at all the different methods of treatment that we've tried over the years, and saline nebs, in terms of evidence and studies, there's no good evidence to say that saline nebs are beneficial in terms of improving or reducing need for oxygen or reducing length of stay or any kind of primary outcome that you could think of, really.
Yeah.
So not thought to be useful.
And then in terms of other things that have been tried and discounted.
Oh, blimey, I think pretty much everything's been tried.
There's still no cure.
No, there really is no cure. I wonder if we'll look back in 30 years and we'll listen to this and laugh because someone will have had a cure. But anyway, you will find people saying, oh, anecdotally, you know, it works. And for bigger babies, some people think that lipotropion can be more useful, and I think it practice varies from place to place, but if you look at the big RCTs and if you look at NICE, they suggest that bronchodilators have no place in the treatment of bronchiolitis, nor do oral steroids, inhaled steroids, hypertonic saline. What else has been used?
Nebulized adrenaline.
No place for it. It doesn't work. Various other places, nitric oxide, all sorts of things. So we'll look at the NICE guidance regarding other treatments that might be used in bronchiolitis or have been historically. The NICE guidance in point 1.4.3 says, do not use any of the following to treat bronchiolitis in children. Antibiotics, because it's a virus. hypertonic saline, adrenaline nebulized, salbutamol, montelukast, ipratropium bromide, systemic or inhaled corticosteroids, and finally a combination of systemic corticosteroids and nebulized adrenaline. So essentially, nothing works.
Nothing works.
we all feel like we want to do something. I think that's the thing.
Yeah.
But actually, it gives parents the wrong expectation, I think, when we're starting to kind of throw lots of medicines. And if we can, across the board, all be doing the same thing, it gives parents a lot more confidence that we're not just holding on to those life-saving drugs and not giving them to their babies.
Yeah.
Nasal suctioning. So at home, you'll find all sorts of little suckers that you can buy in Boots that suck the snot out of babies' noses by various different methods, which sound pretty disgusting. Parents love it because they want to feel like they're doing something, and that's the reason that parents use things like dehumidifiers and your sort of Vicks nase rubs and all that sort of stuff that don't work. They just want to do something. Nasal suctioning. So in hospital, actually, the NICE guidance suggests that nasal suctioning just before feeds can be of use. We know that if you suck snot, snot just returns. But actually, for a temporary, let's try and clear the nose while the baby feeds, it may be useful. It's the only thing.
Yeah, okay. Okay, so just say we're on the maximum treatment that we've got on the ward. So we're on high flow, maximum flow, we're in quite a lot of oxygen, baby's on IV fluids, there's no oral feeds going in at all. Where can we go from there, or what's potentially likely to happen? Because I imagine parents would be quite worried at this point.
Yeah, absolutely. So CPAP and BiPAP is an option.
Do you see that used much?
It very much depends on the unit that you're working in. I think in some of the bigger units across Wessex, where they've got the kit, B, got the nurses who are trained to use it and comfortable with using it, and C, have got the monitoring availability. So obviously, if you've got a child on CPAP, they need to be in a high dependency area at least, with continuous cardiac monitoring, continuous saturation monitoring, obviously. So it is often limited by what's available, and certainly in the smaller district generals, I think it's harder to often just get hold of the machines. Sometimes we will have help, certainly in at Dorset County, we sometimes have help from the special care baby unit in terms of setting up the CPAP, because the nurses are much more used to doing that. But CPAP is certainly useful for some babies that do seem to require true PEEP, so end expiratory pressure. And there have been head-to-head studies done with high flow versus PEEP, versus CPAP, with no real sort of advantage of either. There is a slightly increased risk of complications, it seems, with CPAP in terms of particularly thinking about pneumothorax. That is, it does seem to be less with high flow, but that's small. I think with these babies that are clearly deteriorating, CPAP is often a bit of a holding measure, actually, and ultimately lots of these really tiny and very seriously ill babies end up getting intubated. For exactly as we've mentioned already, they often do need to have lots and lots of suctioning and physiotherapy, a sort of active clearance of the secretions that are sort of contributing to their hypoxia. Yeah, we do, you know, there are a number of babies over the winter period who will need to be intubated, ventilated, and therefore transferred to PICU for management.
It must be full of babies with bronchiolitis at the moment.
Yes, so I think it's a real challenge. It's a real challenge for PICU over the winter months, because they obviously have their planned cardiac operations, and those kids need to be kept well away from this horrible RSV. So it becomes a nursing, a sort of management, a bed difficulty. But yeah, lots of these babies do end up in PICU.
And generally, in terms of outcome, once they've, so even if they get escalated to PICU and have a period of intubation, do they generally do well?
Yes. So the natural course is generally to improve and have no long-term complications. There are a group of children who will have lung damage following bronchiolitis. So bronchiolitis obliterans is a really awful chronic respiratory condition, which can happen secondary to bronchiolitis as a small baby, and can cause lots of kind of ongoing and long-term respiratory problems. But yeah, the general pattern is that babies will improve, and you know, we see babies who have want to do the inverted commas sign, but we're on a podcast, so you can't see me doing that. But a recurrent is the word I'm thinking about. So recurrent bronchiolitis, which I'm not sure if it really is a thing or not. So there are babies who seem to get bronchiolitis a lot, and whether they do have an underlying sort of respiratory compromise that makes them more vulnerable, I think it's unclear. Often they are babies who are ex-prem babies, and actually probably their lung development is still immature. But yeah, there's nothing to say that if you have lots of bronchiolitis as a baby, you go on to develop asthma. So parents always ask
that.
They
always ask that.
Does it mean they've got asthma, doctor? And it's not. It's, you know, it's a viral infection. It's a viral lower respiratory tract infection, bronchiolitis, which is entirely separate to asthma. Now, obviously, it's common, and so is asthma. So there are some babies who will have bronchiolitis and will go on to develop asthma as children, but there is no causative link.
Yeah. Just going back to talk about investigations a little bit, I guess I've got two questions. So it's caused by RSV or adenovirus, and we sometimes do NPAs, don't we, but not always. Mm-hmm. So there's that. And also the role of chest x-rays.
Yeah.
Do you mind just
going
through those?
So NPAs, they can be useful. So if you know what bug you've got, and everyone's got the same bug, everyone can be nursed together, because there's no risk of kind of giving someone who hasn't got the bug. So essentially RSV bays
is cohort,
exactly, nursing. Cohorting nursing, and it is, you know, it's a real thing. We've talked a little bit about bed stress and PICU, but bed stress in our district generals is really you know, it's significant over the winter period. And so actually, if you can keep some of your side rooms free and actually cohort babies together, that can be useful. In terms of other reasons why you do an NPA, lots of people there are lots of different opinions about it. I think if you've got a child who's perhaps not behaving classically, and you're actually wondering whether this is bronchiolitis, if you're kind of using it to help you guide your diagnosis, that can also be another reason to do an NPA.
Yeah, so you're not doing it to get a diagnosis, but you're getting it.
No.
It might help if you've got questions.
Yeah, it might help you confirm your suspicions if it's not totally. So perhaps, maybe with those babies who are, we talked about the apneic premature babies who don't have classical symptoms right at the beginning, but if you do manage to get an NPA that has RSV, you might then feel more confident that you're not missing something underlying.
Yeah, that's a great point. And then chest X-rays.
Chest X-rays. So I would say a chest X-ray isn't indicated in the majority of babies with bronchiolitis. So if you've got your classical clinical presentation and a baby is behaving like it's got bronchiolitis and it's responding like it's got bronchiolitis, then a chest X-ray is not going to change your management. And my question is always, when I'm doing an investigation, how is this going to change things? I think if you're worried that the baby may have a bacterial infection, so an additional sort of a super added bacterial pneumonia, which can be a complication of viral bronchiolitis, and you again, I'd still maybe question the whether that is going to change anything, but we do, when babies are deteriorating, there perhaps is more of a place. The other thing that we would think about is if we're considering whether a baby has a pneumothorax, then that would obviously that would be an indication to chest X-ray, as long as it wasn't a tension. What we often see with the seriously sick babies with bronchiolitis is a right upper lobe collapse. It's a classical kind of thing we see with complicated bronchiolitis. Obviously, if you're going to intubate a baby, you're going to need to get a chest X-ray to confirm your tube position, so that would be another reason why you would do a chest X-ray. But I think we probably do too many chest X-rays. It feels like a comfortable thing to do because we can just do it, and it's only a little bit of radiation, and well, let's just get a chest X-ray. But I think I would really I'd kind of challenge people to ask themselves, what's it going to change? Why are we doing it?
So I think one last thing that would be useful to talk about is discharge criteria, especially in terms of oxygen saturations.
So I talked about oxygen saturations as being a reason to admit children, and if their sats are below 92% in primary care or in your assessment unit, you would certainly want to assess that baby for a little bit longer and just see what happened to the oxygen requirement. As babies are improving, perhaps they've had a night on PAU, or maybe they've had, I don't know, 3 or 4 days in your children's ward with some oxygen therapy and with some NG feeding, and they're starting to improve. Often we get to the stage where they're just needing this sort of trickle of oxygen, and there's this big question about how low are the sats allowed to go?
Yeah,
that's like a little poem. And so there was a big study done, and it was published in The Lancet in 2015 called the BIDS study, looking at the time taken for symptoms to resolve. That was the primary outcome in babies with bronchiolitis. And what they did, they were really clever, they did something to a sats machine that made it say that the sats were 94 when the sats were actually only 90. So everybody thought that the baby had sats of 94, but actually the baby only had sats of 90.
So they acted on having sats of 94 when actually the baby's going on sats of 90.
So basically, so that was in one cohort, and then the other group had had a normal saturation monitor. Yeah. So essentially, one group only got oxygen when the sats went below 90, whereas the others got it at 94, and below 94. And there was basically no difference in those two groups in terms of the resolution of symptoms. Yeah. And so what they suggested was, actually, we could probably, if babies are keeping their saturations above 90%, that would be our kind of cutoff for then for discharge. Now, what we talked about when we were discussing this was that the neurocognitive outcomes weren't studied as part of this trial. And I think what parents, I think generally what we worry about is, oh yes, but if a child's persistently hypoxic, isn't it damaging their brain, doctor? And I think that the argument they give in the BIDS trial was that we have a whole cohort of kids who have obstructive sleep apnea, who have been well studied, that run their sats in the sort of high 80s, low 90s for months to potentially years on end, and their neurocognitive outcomes are okay. And actually, these babies have a very short period where their sats are kind of lowish, and actually their argument is that the neurodevelopmental or neurocognitive outcomes are likely to be very insignificant.
That makes total sense. So that, because that could make a massive difference to the the workload on the ward.
Absolutely.
Because we know the baby's got better, and we're just waiting for them to be able to go home, and it's waiting for them to sleep.
That's
and
right.
Not need wafting oxygen.
That's right. And I think the practice is changing.
Yeah.
I think it's changing in some places quicker than in other places. But yeah, I think there is an argument to say that if the baby is improving, has got kind of over the worst of it, is feeding okay, and sats are above 90%, it's okay to go home. It's getting better. And you know, with really good safety netting, which can be provided via Healthier Together with the excellent bronchiolitis handout, which will again just show parents what to worry about in terms of if the baby's going backwards and is having more features in the amber box or the red box, then they need to give us a call and we'll reassess the baby.
So essentially bronchiolitis is going to run its course, and it might be a rough course, but it will
resolve. That's exactly right. And like I said, I think it's just really important to manage parents' expectations and to let them know that often, especially with the little babies, the neonates, they're going to be in hospital for, you know, sometimes a week or so. And in terms of resolution of symptoms, again, when they go home, they're not going to be completely better when they go home.
Yeah.
So explaining to parents that the likelihood is they're going to cough and wheeze for several weeks, probably after after discharge, and that is a group of babies that will continue to cough and wheeze for months to a year, or sometimes even over a year, as a result of their lungs recovering from bronchiolitis. And if they are well in themselves, feeding okay, growing okay, it's okay for them to cough and wheeze.
Yeah, that's really useful to know, isn't it? Because it's such a simple thing that someone comes back 4 months after bronchiolitis, they're still wheezing and coughing, and just to be able to say that is really helpful.
And I think if we, you know, if we preempt it and let parents know that that might happen, they worry about it a lot less.
Yeah.
Brilliant. Thank you so much, Claire. I think we've covered quite a lot about bronchiolitis today, and I think this is going to be really useful actually for GPs and medical and nursing staff in hospitals too. Hopefully using resources like Wessex Healthcare Together is going to make communication between primary and secondary care a lot easier, to make sure that we're all using the same framework. Also, the parent information leaflets are invaluable, and I know that in Dorset County we definitely give them out every time someone goes home with that condition. It's just a really good way of safety netting. So thank you so much for your time, for your input and your thoughts on bronchiolitis.
That's okay.
I think that's bronchiolitis pretty much covered, so thank you so much once again, Dr. Claire Hollingsworth, for joining me, Caroline Story, on Fontenelle. And until next time, goodbye.
Thank you for taking the time to listen to this podcast from Don't Forget the Bubbles. Remember, you can subscribe to our feed on iTunes and Spotify. Thank you for listening.